This quietude and tranquility in God is not entirely obscure to the soul as is a dark night, but it is a tranquility and quietude in divine light, in the new knowledge of God, in which the spirit elevated to the divine light is in quiet. She very appropriately calls this divine light the rising dawn, which means the morning. Just as the rise of morning dispels the darkness of night and unveils the light of day, so this spirit, quieted and put to rest in God, is elevated from the darkness of natural knowledge to the morning light of the supernatural knowledge of God. This morning light is not clear, as was said, but dark as night at the time of the rising dawn, just as the night at the rise of dawn is not entirely night nor entirely day, but is, as they say, at the break of day. So this divine solitude and tranquility, informed by the divine light, has some share in that light, but not its complete clarity. In this tranquility, the intellect is aware of being elevated with strange newness, above all natural understanding, to the divine light. Just as a person who after a long sleep opens his eyes to the unexpected light. I think David was referring to this knowledge when he said, I have kept watch and am become like a solitary sparrow on the housetop. Psalm 101. This was like saying, I opened the eyes of my intellect and found myself above all natural knowledge. Without this knowledge and alone on the housetop, which is above all low things. He says he became like a solitary sparrow, because in this contemplation the spirit has the traits of a solitary sparrow. There are five of these traits. First, the sperrow ordinarily perches on the highest thing, and so the spirit at this stage is placed in the highest contemplation. Second, it is always turns its beak toward the wind. Thus the spirit ever turns the beak of its affection toward the spirit of love, who is God. Third, it is usually alone and allows no other bird close to it, for when another perches nearby, it flies away. Thus the spirit in this contemplation is alone in regard to all things, strip them all, nor does it allow within itself anything other than solitude in God. The fourth trait, that it sings very sweetly, and so does the spirit sing sweetly to God at this time, for the praises it renders him are of the most delightful love, pleasant to the soul and precious in God's eyes. The fifth is that it possesses no definite color, so neither does the perfect spirit in its excess have any color of sensible affection or self-love. It does not even have any particular consideration in either its lower or higher part, nor will it be able to describe the mode or manner of this excess. For what it possesses is an abyss of the knowledge of God. Silent music. In that nocturnal tranquility and silence, and in that knowledge of the divine light, the soul becomes aware of wisdom's wonderful harmony and sequence in the variety of his creatures and works. Each of them is endowed with a certain likeness to God, and in its own way gives voice to what God is in it. So creatures will be for the soul a harmonious symphony of sublime music, surpassing all concerts and melodies of the world. She calls this music silent because it is tranquil and quiet knowledge without the sound of voices, and thus there is in it the sweetness of music and the quietude of silence. Accordingly, she says that her beloved is silent music, because in him she knows and enjoys the symphony of spiritual music. Not only is he silent music, but he is also sounding solitude. This is almost identical with silent music, for even though that mosaic is silent to the natural senses and faculties, it is sounding solitude for the spiritual faculties. When these spiritual faculties are alone and empty of all natural forms and apprehensions, they can receive in a most sonorous way the spiritual sound of the excellence of God in himself and in his creatures. We said above that Saint John speaks of this spiritual vision in the Apocalypse, that is, the voice of many harpers playing on their harps. This vision was spiritual and had nothing to do with material harps. It involved a knowledge of the praises that each of the blessed in his own degree of glory gives continually to God. This praise is like music, for as each one possesses God's gifts differently, each one sings his praises differently, and all of them together form a symphony of love, as of music. In this same way, the soul perceives in that tranquil wisdom that all creatures, higher and lower, ones alike, according to what each in itself has received from God, raise their voice in testimony to what God is. She beholds that each in its own way, bearing God within itself, according to its capacity, magnifies God, and thus all these voices from one voice of music, praising the grandeur, wisdom, and wonderful knowledge of God. This is the meaning of the Holy Spirit in the Book of Wisdom, when he said, "The Spirit of the Lord filled the whole earth, and this world, which contains all things, has knowledge of the voice." Wisdom 1:7. This voice is the sonorous solitude the soul knows here, that is, the testimony to God which in themselves all things give. Since the soul does not receive this sonorous music without solitude and estrangement from all exterior things, she calls it silent music and sounding solitude, which she says is her beloved. And what is more, the supper that refreshes and deepens love. Supper affords lovers refreshment, satisfaction, and love, since in this gentle communication, the beloved produces these three benefits in the soul. She calls it the supper that refreshes and deepens love. It should be known that in the divine scripture, this term supper refers to the divine vision. Just as supper comes to at the end of the day's work and at the beginning of the evening rest, this tranquil knowledge causes the soul to experience a certain end of her evils and possession of good things, in which her love of God is deepened more than before. As a result, he is the supper that refreshes by being the end of the evils for her, and that deepens love by being to her the possession of all good. Yet for a better understanding of what this supper is to the soul, it is, as we said, her beloved. We should note in this appropriate place what the beloved bridegroom says in the Apocalypse. I stood at the door and knock. If anyone opens, I shall enter and supper with him, and he with me. In this text, he indicates that he carries his supper with him, and it is nothing but his own very delights and savors that he himself enjoys. In uniting himself with the soul, he imparts them, and she likewise enjoys them. For such is the meaning of the words, I shall supper with him, and he with me. Hence these words declare the effect of the divine union of the soul with God, in which God's very own goods are graciously and bounteously shared in common with his bride, the soul. He himself is for her the supper that refreshes and enamors, for in being bounteous he refreshes her, and in being gracious he enamors her. Before continuing with the commentary on the remaining stanzas, we ought to point out here that even though we have said that in this state of espousal the soul enjoys complete tranquility and receives the most abundant communication possible in this life, it should be understood that this tranquility refers only to the superior part. Until the state of spiritual marriage, the sensory part never completely loses the dross left from bad habits or brings all its energies into subjection, as will be said later, and that this communication is the most abundant possible to the state of espousal. In the spiritual marriage, there are striking advantages over the state of espousal, for although the bride, the soul, enjoys so much good in these visits of the state of espousal, still she suffers from her beloved's withdrawal and from disturbances and afflictions in her sensory part and from the devil. All of these cease in the state of marriage. Stanza 16, Introduction. Since the virtues of the bride are perfect, and she enjoys habitual peace in the visits of her beloved, she sometimes has a sublime enjoyment of their sweetness and fragrance when her beloved touches these virtues. Just as a man enjoys the sweetness and beauty of flowers and lilies when they have blossomed, and he must handle them. In many of these visits, the soul sees within herself all her virtues by means of the light of the bridegroom causes. And then in a wonderful delight of love, she gathers them together and offers them to him as a bouquet of beautiful flowers. And he, in accepting them, for indeed he accepts them, receives great service. This all occurs interiorly. The soul feels that the beloved is within her, as in his own bed. She offers herself together with her virtues, which is the greatest service she can render him. Thus, one of the most remarkable delights she receives in her interior communion with God comes from this gift of herself to her beloved. The devil, who in his great malice is envious of all the good that he sees in the soul, knowing of her prosperity, now employs all his ability and engages all his crafts to disturb even a slight part of this good. It is worth more to him to hinder a small fraction of this soul's rich and glorious delight than to make many others fall into numerous serious sin, for these others have little or nothing to lose, and this soul has very much to lose because of all her precious gain. The loss of a little pure gold is much worse than the loss of many other base metals. The devil at this point takes advantage of the sensory appetites, although most of the time he can do very little or nothing, since these appetites in persons having reached this state are already deadened. When he is unable to stir these appetites, he produces a great variety of images in the imagination. He is sometimes the cause of many movements in the sensory part of the soul and of many other disturbances, spiritual as well as sensory. It is not in a person's power to be free of these until the Lord sends his angel, as is said in the Psalms, round about them that fear him and delivers them, Psalm 33. And until he brings peace and tranquility, both in the sensory and spiritual part of the soul. Referring to the devil's disturbances and distrustful of the wiles he uses to cause her harm at the time, the soul, seeking this favor from God, speaks to the angels, whose duty it is to assist her now by putting the devil to flight. She recites the following stanza. Catch us the foxes, for our vineyard is now in flower, while we fashion a cone of roses, intricate as the pine, and let no one appear on the hill. Commentary. Desirous that neither the envious and malicious devils, nor the wild sensory appetites, nor the various wanderings of the imagination, nor any other knowledge or awareness hamper the continuance of this interior delight of love, which is the flower of her vineyard, the bride invokes the angels, telling them to catch all of these disturbances and keep them from interfering with the interior exercise of love, in the delight of which the virtues and graces are communicated and enjoyed by the soul and the Son of God. And thus she says, catch us the foxes, for our vineyard is now in flower. The vineyard spoken of is the nursery of all the virtues in this holy soul. These virtues supply her with a sweet-tasting wine. This vineyard is in flower when the soul is united with her bridegroom according to the will and gladdened in him according to all these virtues together. Frequently, as we said, many various kinds of images are brought to the memory and fantasy, and many appetites and inclinations are stirred up in the sensory part. These are of so many kinds that when David was drinking this delicious spiritual wine with intense thirst for God, he proclaimed upon experiencing the hindrance they caused, my soul has thirsted for you, O how many ways my flesh for you, Psalm 62. The soul calls all this harmonious composite of appetites and sensory movements, foxes, because of the great resemblance. As foxes pretend to be asleep when they are not, to catch their prey, so all of these appetites and sensory powers are tranquil and asleep until these flowers of virtues rise and blossom in the soul in an exercise of love. At that moment, then, it seems that the sensual flowers of the appetites and sense powers awaken and arise in the sensory part of the soul in an effort to contradict the spirit and reign. Covetousness will reach such a point, as St. Paul says, that the flesh covets against the spirit. Galatians 5:17. Since the flesh has a strong inclination to sensory things, that which pleases the spirit is distasteful and unpleasant to all flesh. As a result, these appetites are a notable disturbance to the sweet spirit. Thus, she says, catch us, the foxes. The malicious demons, on their part, disturb the soul in two ways. They vehemently incite and stimulate these appetites, and by means of them and other imaginations, wage war on this peaceful and flowering kingdom of the soul. In the second way, which is worse, they assail her with bodily torment and noises in order to distract her. When it is impossible for them to do so in this first way, and what is still worse, they struggle against her with spiritual terrors and horrors that sometimes become a frightful torment. If permission is given them, they can do this very easily, for since the soul at this time enters into great nakedness of spirit for the sake of this spiritual exercise, the devil can easily show himself to her, because he is also spirit. At other times, he attacks her with different horrors before she begins to enjoy these sweet flowers, when God is beginning to withdraw her from the house of the senses, that she may enter through this interior exercise the garden of her bridegroom. The devil knows that once the soul has entered into that recollection, she is so fortified that however much he may try, he cannot do her harm. Frequently, when he goes out to block the soul, she recollects herself very quickly in her deep interior hiding place, where she finds intense delight and protection. Then the terrors she suffers seem so exterior and far away that the devils not only fail to frighten her, but they cause happiness and joy. The bride of the Canticle spoke of these terrors, saying, "My soul troubles me because of the chariots of Anawamab, Canticles 6:11. By Aminadab, she refers to the devil. She calls his attacks and assaults chariots because of the terrible violence and clamor he produces with them. The soul afterwards says here, "Catch us, the foxes." This very request was made by the bride of the Canticles. Catch us, the little foxes that damage the vines, for our vineyard is in flower. Canticles 2:15. She does not say, "Catch me," but "Catch us," because she is speaking of both herself and the beloved. They are united and enjoying the flower of the virtue.